So we are in the end of Perek Chet, the end of chapter 8 in Shmuel. And a class that I taught at Beth Emeth yesterday, actually, I was talking to one of my kids about it, and it led to an idea also regarding what we've been talking about with the monarchy. Remember that our focus the last few times has been the Jews' request for a king, and what was wrong with the request, and why did God choose to go along with it? So, what we had concluded, the last idea that we had, which seemed very sound, was that what the Jews were looking for was a king who would be the source of authority. Right? L'shofteinu. To judge us, k'chol ha-goyim, like happens among the nations, which is the king makes the laws. And what they were supposed to do was, yes, have a king, but the king would have a Sefer Torah, and the king would listen to the Navi, the prophet, would go to the Kohen Gadol to ask for guidance from Hashem in military situations and that sort of thing. So what they were looking for was a king who would be the source of authority, where really what they should have been looking for was a king who would be a conduit of divine authority. That was their big mistake. So the only difference is, really, going back to what we said when we started Sefer Shoftim, I don't remember if you were here at that point, but what we talked about there were the hereditary nature of the position, as one example, but there were a few elements which made a king more powerful than a shofet. We had different views even at the time, it's not so clear-cut, but there are differences. This is going to be familiar for Eddie, who was there yesterday, Diane, who listened to it online. Ricky, I don't know if you were there yesterday. Were you there yesterday? You weren't there yesterday, right?
No.
Okay, so it'll be new for you. But
the link. I'll listen to it.
Oh, now you're going to hear it. Well, you're here part of it now. So it was the last session in a series on. Oh, Linda, I'm sorry. You're so quiet during class. It's true. So Linda was there also. Some of you will know this. But in any case, this was the fourth in a four-part series on mysticism and mitzvot, talking about how Kabbalah understands what you're doing when you perform a mitzvah. And we were looking at Shabbos, and what exactly is happening with when a person observes Shabbos. Now, we spent a lot of time on it. I'm not doing the entire session here. But here's the part that's relevant for us in our discussion. As part of it, we talked about the issue of royalty. Now, again, if you heard yesterday's shiur, you're ineligible to answer this question. But I want adjectives. When I say royalty to you, what adjectives come to mind?
Power.
Wealth.
Right.
Sorry?
Authority.
Authority. Dominance. Right? That's what we usually think of. But Kabbalah looks at what a king or what royalty is in a deeper way, and it turns on its head the idea of, in the context of that shiur, Shabbos as royalty. I mean, we talk about Shabbat HaMalkah, Shabbos as the queen, the Gemara says it, L'chadodi, Ma'idilu Menuchatecha, Shabbat HaMalkah, Malav HaMalkah. We have all of these uses of Shabbat as royalty, but with a refined idea of what royalty really is. Where does a king's power, where does royalty's power come from? What gives a king power? Don't say descending from another king, because that just pushes the question back a generation.
The people.
The people. Correct. The authority of monarchy stems from those who appoint and recognize the monarch. In Judaism, it's God, right? But it devolves upon the people to actually choose the king, and the different procedures for that are a discussion for another time. Where does the king's wealth come from?
Treasury.
Right, the people. The people who either pay the taxes, or the people who serve in the army and conquer an area and therefore bring in wealth, or the people who did this, who did that in previous generations and therefore this king inherited it. So the king has no inherent power. The king has no inherent wealth. The king doesn't produce wealth. And now, what is a king supposed to do, I underline supposed to do, with that wealth and with that power?
make sure that the country is safe and secure.
Use it for the nation. Distribute it to the population, whether that's in defense, whether that's in the roads, whatever it is that the king is supposed to do on behalf of the nation. In other words, the king is a vessel. The king has nothing. The king provides nothing. The king is simply the vessel through which power, wealth is used in order to benefit others. Now, if you take a look on your sheet at the first source, I use this couple of lines from Chabad.org rather than create a brand new piece and translate a brand new piece, because it was right there and it said exactly what I was trying to say. It's talking about Malchut. This is one of the Sfirot. The Sfirot are the means by which Hashem communicates benefit to our world. So it's the last of the Sfirot, meaning Hashem's influence flows through all of them down to Malchut, which again means monarchy. On one hand, Malchut receives all that it has from the other Sfirot and is described in Kabbalah, quote, as having nothing of her own. Thus, the Zohar compares Malchut to the moon, which has no light of her own. It's just reflecting light. On the other hand, Malchut is the final revelation of the divine light for which the entire process began of sending that light to our realm. It was for the purpose of Malchut that all the Sfirot were emanated in order to be able to transmit it. Thus, Malchut is both the receiver and the consummation of giving. That's why the moon has that status. And then I brought you a piece from the Zohar in 2, 3, and 4. I brought you different Zohar pieces. I didn't bring the original Aramaic for you. I apologize. That's what I was thinking. The Zohar points out that in Zechariah, Mashiach is described as Oni v'rochev al hachamor, a pauper riding on a donkey. And the Zohar is bothered because Mashiach is Melech HaMashiach. Mashiach is a king. He is anointed. What do you mean he's a pauper? And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai explains, he has nothing of his own. Because kings don't own anything, really. It's the property of the state. And we call him King Mashiach. We give him that title. And that's also the idea, as you see here in the Zohar, of saying that of the moon, that the moon has an aspect of Malchut. In source number 3, this is a longer discussion, but I brought it anyway. Sarah, remember that Sarah, as in Avram and Sarah, right? Her name means?
Princess.
Royalty. Really, a Sar is a noble. Right? One who has power. Sarara is authority. Sarah is a person of authority. So she has this aspect of Malchut, and therefore also, things come in and they go out. Nothing sticks to her. And therefore, as the Zohar presents it, she's able to be in the palace of Paro, she's able to be in the palace of Abimelech, and it doesn't affect her. It doesn't affect her. She has Malchut. Nothing, it's not about her. The application of this to Shabbos is fascinating, and I thought it worth bringing here, even though we're learning Shmuel. Nonetheless, I think it's brilliant what the Zohar says here in number 4, and it's another thing that I never thought of, certainly. Man, right? That's how we ate in the Midbar. How much man fell on a Sunday? One measure. Monday? One measure. Tuesday, one measure. Shabbos, how many measures?
Zero.
Zero, right? Shabbos, we were fed by the man that fell on Friday, the double portion, hence the double loaf of bread, lechem mishnah at our meals on Shabbos. Good, we understand that. Shabbos is a day that Hashem blesses, Hashem gives a bracha to. So how come it doesn't get man? There's bracha. If Hashem blesses the day, I would think we should get something, right? That's what a bracha is. Brachas are gifts. Take a look at source number 4. Zachor es yom haShabbos lekadsho, called to mind the day of Shabbat to sanctify it. Rabbi Yitzchak said, Bracious, Parak Beis Pasuk Gimel, says, and God blessed the seventh day. And regarding the man, Shmo says, you shall gather it for 6 days, there will be none on Shabbat. If no food is found on that day, what blessing is found there? It's a good question, no? Never thought of that. But we have learned thus. All blessings above and below depend on the seventh day. Meaning, all bracha you ever receive stems from Shabbos. And we have learned, why was man not found on the seventh day? Because all of the higher 6 days, Sunday through Friday, are blessed from that day, from Shabbos. Each one provides food to the day below it, each on its day, and from that blessing which is received on the seventh day. So in other words, Shabbos has Malchus. Right? Shabbos has that aspect of receiving blessing from Hashem and sending it on to the rest of the week. Therefore, one who is on the level of faith, and that's talking about the fact that Shabbos is about believing that Hashem created the world, runs it, took us out of Egypt. One who is on the level of faith must set his table and prepare his meal for the nighttime meal of Shabbos, just like in the desert you would take the man and prepare the man, so that his table will be blessed for all of those 6 days. For at that time, the blessing for all 6 days of the week comes, and the blessing is not found on an empty table. Right? Hashem will only send bracha if you do something. You have to have something to start it. Therefore, one must set his table for the night of Shabbos with bread and food.
Why do you have a double challah on Shabbos? Didn't you have two challahs on Friday? Night?
Yes, that's a classic question. So I should really commemorate the month on Friday. Right? Why am I commemorating the month with my meal on Shabbos? And the answer is because you have Shabbos meals. You don't have Friday meals.
It's already Shabbat.
Friday night. You do. That's already Shabbos. Right. Plus, now we'll say, because you're benefiting from it on Shabbos, meaning that's when you're actually using it. You only use one portion then, and the second day, the second challah is really, you know, your second portion of man is your Shabbos portion. But I think this is a fascinating idea in terms of what it teaches us about monarchy and what monarchy is about within Judaism. But I think it also fits very well with what we've said about Shaul. I wasn't looking for an excuse to rehash what I did on Wednesday. I think it fits very well what we're saying about having a king here. The people want a king who will have a personal identity as the arbiter of everything, the source of power, the generator of law. And what we've said is that's not what a king is supposed to be. The king is supposed to be the conduit through whom the power flows, created by Hashem, recognized by the people, flows through this person for the benefit of the nation. This person is not supposed to be the originator. So I think the ideas actually blend really nicely, this idea of Malchus. Okay. So the nation says, we want a king. Shmuel gives them the warning, which we read last time around, right? The week before Purim. We had that Purim break. But we said that Shmuel gave them this whole warning of the terrible things kings are going to do. 7 different layers of bad things. Right? Parallel, we said, perhaps to the Tohacha, the warnings of punishment. He's going to take your sons. He's going to take your daughters. You're going to have to give him your fields and orchards for his servants or his nobles. You're going to have to give him your crops, again, for those servants or nobles. He's going to take your servants and youths for himself. He's going to take your sheep for himself, and you will be his slaves.
And in donkeys.
Donkeys are part of that, yes.
And so faith doesn't take any of those things.
Ostensibly not.
Yeah, so why do I want
to? So, well, Shmuel says to them, that's what we're getting to, but Shmuel says to them, either kings are licensed to do this, that was one view, or alternatively, they don't have the right to do it, but you should know that's what you're getting into. They're going to do it. They're going to be bad. Your kings are not going to follow the rules, and they're going to take everything you have. However you read it, we now get the nation's response. Take a look, please. Parakhet, chapter 8, sentences 19 to 22. Vayimanu ha'am lishmoa b'kol Shmuel. The nation refused to listen to Shmuel. Vayomru lo, they said, no. Ki melech ye'aleinu. There's going to be a king over us. Vahayinu gam anachnu k'chol ha'goyim. We'll be like everybody else. Ushfatanu malkeinu. Our king will judge us. V'yatzalefaneinu v'nachames milchamoseinu. He is going to travel before us. He is going to fight our wars. Vayishma Shmuel is called Divrei Ha'am by Debrim Be'aznei Hashem. Shmuel heard what the nation said, and he reported it back to God. And Vayomer Hashem al Shmuel, Shma b'kolam, and Hashem said to Shmuel, listen to them. V'imlach t'lehem melech, give him a king. Vayomer Shmuel al Anshei Yisrael, l'chu ish li'ro. And Shmuel says to the people, go home.
It's a weird thing to say. When you say, okay, I'll get you a king.
Well, because, you know, it takes time. You can't just go to Toys R Us.
Yeah, I'm going to Toys R Us.
Actually, does Toys R Us exist anymore?
Yeah,
Canada does. Okay, good. We're still good. We can still get a care.
My mother used to say, okay, do whatever you want, but if there's a problem, don't come to me.
Yeah, that works well. They still come back to you. But here, like, what are the questions that we have here? What bothers us in these psukim? Diane already asked one question.
Why
are they so bent on this? Yeah. Now that you've gotten the warning from Shmuel, who you trust, who you know, who they're going to continue to trust, as we'll see in Parakeet Bet.
They won't be back. Everybody has been so bad. They didn't take anything from them.
I mean, Shmuel is going to continue to function. You have to also realize, Shaul is going to become king, and Shmuel is going to continue to lead.
I'm not going to pay two
people. Yes.
I don't remember. Did Shmuel tell them that he's quoting what God has said? Hashem
yes.
said to him?
Yes.
He does. So
yes.
They know that it comes from Hashem, and yet they still.
Yeah.
But Shmuel sounds more like a threat, like a prophecy of doom.
Yeah.
That's like,
I mean, one of two ways, but yeah.
So, and also, why does Shmuel have to tell God? Because God already knows. Or is he just.
Yeah, so that's the other question here. Why does Shmuel need to tell God? You've got a similar thing in Parshas Yisro, right? At the beginning of the Parsha, the Jews are standing at Har Sinai, right? And Hashem says to Moshe, tell them that, you know, this is the covenant and so on, and the people say, we accept it or whatever, and then Moshe goes back to God to tell him.
He knows.
I think God's aware probably of what the people said. If not, we have a bigger problem.
He already did this before, right before.
He checked with God.
Right, but he doesn't need to go tell God what the people said.
He was still unsettled, clearly.
I mean, the easy answer is that Shmuel needs to go back to get orders. You know, like Moshe in Yisro. Moshe needs to know, okay, so now what? So he goes back to tell God, but it really means he goes back to get orders. But the turn of phrase is strange. The turn of phrase is, you know, he went back, what was it? Vayidabrein ba'aznei Hashem. He spoke into God's ears. The language of it is very odd.
Mm-hmm. The art school says repeated them.
Yeah. They
that doesn't help me.
I know. It's the corporality.
Yeah, incorporeal.
But could it be like Shakespeare in your ear?
Sorry?
You know, that sort of saying,
right. Lend me your ears.
Help me understand this question.
Oh, looking for advice.
I'm thinking he just needs to vent and he's got nobody else to do it.
Maybe. Could be. Everyone needs to vent, right? So let's look at the first question first. Why does the nation say no to Shmuel? So I think in order to understand this, you have to go back to the question of whether Shmuel was saying the king is licensed to do this, or whether Shmuel was saying the king is going to act illegally. If he's warning that the king is going to act illegally, the king is going to do things that he does not lawfully have the right to do, then I'll take Malbim's approach. Take a look at source number 5. Malbim explains the people's response. Lo kidvarcha, not as you say, that he is going to be a tyrant who's not going to listen to the Torah and its laws. That's not called a melech. That's called a tyrant. Meaning, and this is a key idea in Malbim, which has applications elsewhere in Tanakh. Malbim, remember, when you're learning Tanakh, this is a good thing to know. When you're learning Tanakh and you come across a word that looks like it's very similar to another word and you can't understand why you chose this word instead of that word, always, always refer to Malbim. Malbim loves to find distinctions between words that appear synonymous and to use it to explain nuance. So, for example, in the case that's relevant here, we have a pasuk. Ki lashem ha-melucha u-moshel baguyim. Melucha, monarchy, belongs to God, and he is the Moshel. He is the Moshel among the nations. Why did you change from Lucha to Moshel? So Malbim says a Melech is someone that people recognize. We accept a king. A Moshel is someone who rules by force. And with Hashem, you can have it your way, but he's going to be ruling over you either way. He can be a Melech, he can be a Moshel. But either way, Hashem is going to reign over you. So, applying that here, he says, look at the wording. when it says here, what the people say to Shmuel is, Lo ki melech ye'aleinu. He's not going to be a Moshel over us. He is going to be a melech, meaning he is going to do things properly. He's not going to be a tyrant. And now I just continue with the Malbim because I realized I stopped in the middle. He's not going to be a Moshe. He's going to be a Melech. We will not be bound to him as his slaves. He will be bound to us to follow the law. So if what Shmuel was saying was, he's not licensed to do these things, but he's going to do them anyway, the people's response is, no, we'll get a good king. Not to worry. We're good at this.
When you get Shlomo's son.
Rehavam. That's a Moshe.
Yeah, but they didn't get a choice. He came anyway.
Yes, because it didn't play out the way they thought it would. Correct. Yes.
Perhaps the people just trusted Shmuel and Hashem to give them the king, the right kind of king that will not do all these things.
Yeah, but that's the problem. You know, when you go to a contractor, right? And you say to the contractor, here's what I would like. And the contractor says, I can't do it that way. Or this isn't going to look the way you think. And you say, please go ahead and do exactly as I said. Then it's your fault. You went to Shmuel and Hashem. Shmuel and Hashem said, it's not going to work that way.
Well,
and they said, oh, don't worry, it's going to be fine. Just do what I'm telling you to do.
Is he saying king will be like that?
Yeah.
The king might be like
that. No. He said, this is going to be what he's going to do. You've been warned.
Or just he's guessing. Cause
he's not guessing. He's Shmuel.
No. He's a lovely.
But Rabbi, is there any chance of using your contractor thing? Maybe they thought that Shmuel was, like his back was up against the wall, because now you're subcontracting my position, so you don't understand anything. Anyway, we're going to do it, and don't worry, it'll be fine.
Well, the problem is they're working through this contractor. They're expecting him to help. Right. It's hard to say that, especially because Shmuel still remains in charge. Mm-hmm. They still go to him. They love him. In Parak Yud Bet, you'll see it. But that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is that Shmuel was warning that the Torah is actually going to let the king do this. In which case, take a look at source number 6, Mitzudat David. Vayomru lo, they said no. Ratzalomar lo nishma elecha, meaning we're not listening to your warnings. That's the idea. There's a third idea that I found it in the Malbim and in the Kli Yakar that suggests that they were actually modifying their original request. The original request was bad, now they're asking for something good, but it's hard to sustain in the words. But those two approaches, either Shmuel is saying he's going to be bad, and they're saying, no, he's going to be good. Or Shmuel is saying, you should know, he's licensed to do a lot of stuff you're not going to like. And they're saying, we're not listening to you anyway. Either way, they reject what he said, and Shmuel reports back to God. And again, what is this report? So it really could be, and the venting idea is humorous, but I'm not sure how it fits, really. The idea that he's going back to get orders makes sense, except that, again, the wording is strange. But look at Radak, source number 7. Kitargumo, he says it's like the Aramaic commentary. Visadrinun kadam Hashem. He arranged them, their words, before God. Klomar bitfilaso, meaning in his prayers. Sheitpaleo la kelshia aneu bitvar hameluha visider divrehem lefanav. He davened to Hashem to answer him regarding the monarchy, and he laid out before God what they had said. So this was part of tefillah, is part of prayer, which makes sense now in terms of why Shmuel tells them to go home. It's not just, I don't have any kings lying around that I can give you, so I need to order them from headquarters. But because Shmuel goes back to Hashem, because now it's a matter between him and God. The people have entered their request. Shmuel is davening to Hashem to follow up. And there's nothing for the people to do. Now it's really just Shmuel working with God to provide a melech. You follow? That's the idea. Okay. Actually, I'm going to start the recording.